Hey, he's not in the seat yet. Hi all, welcome to the Southwest American Writers Festival. These gigs are part of a new partnership between the universities of Arizona and Warwick. At least that's what the paperwork tells me when I'm a suit. But in actual fact, it's really the start of a new friendship between the Warwick Writing Program in Britain and the Virginia Piper Center for Creative Writing in the United States. Now, this partnership means many things to people, but to us together, for the first time in this room, it means writers meeting writers, that's you. It's also getting to know each other's good and bad habits, that's me. And it's also helping each other out with advice and affection, which is them and her and Melissa, who's not here yet. Now, this partnership is not the kind of normal one-night stand of transatlantic cultural cross-fertilization. It actually means many things, and one of the things I will say it means that students and staff here in Coventry will take time out to write under the desert sun of Phoenix, Arizona, and students and staff from Phoenix, Arizona will discover the rapidly increasing annual rainfall of the Midlands. There are two readings today, and this sum equals four authors in all. The distinguished writers Melissa Pritchard and Jewel Parker Rhodes will read here at 7:30 tonight. But now we welcome Ron Carson and Jay Boyer, both of whom gave stunning workshops at the Art Centre last night. Now, I'm going to say a little bit about them, but actually what I'm going to do, to be honest, is I'm going to read you something about them from my auto cue, which has been altered in the last 5 minutes. Now, Ron Carson is the author of 8 books of fiction, most recently his selected stories, A Kind of Flying. His fiction has appeared in Harper's, Gentleman's Quarterly, Esquire, Story, and dozens of other journals and anthologies, including the Norton Anthology of Short Fiction, The Best American Short Stories, and Sudden Fiction. Mr. Carson has been awarded a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship in Fiction and the Plowshares Cohen Prize. A frequent contributor to the New York Times Book Review and the Los Angeles Times Book Review, he also hosts Books and Company on KAET Public Television in Arizona. He is Regents Professor of English at Arizona State University and lives with Elaine Carson and their two sons in Scottsdale, Arizona. Now, he will be reading from a new story which appears in the December Harper's magazine. Now, as for Jay edited this most carefully. Jay Boyer has a number of published books to his credit, and his plays have been put on in Europe and Canada, as well as across the United States. Starring David Marcus, his latest play, The Crown Prince of Perfect, will have its off-Broadway premiere in December. We're very honored to have you guys. The way this is going to work is that Jay will read for 20 minutes, Ron will read for 20 minutes, and then we'll have 20 minutes discussion, and then just about 6 p.m., we'll be out of here with drinks in our hands, because you were all invited to the drinks reception following this in the National Grid Room. Please come. But first of all, will you please welcome Ron Carson and Jay Boyer.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. The story I'm going to read from tonight is relatively recent. It appeared in July or August in a journal in America. The reason I picked it is not because I think it's my best work, but it's because it's about where I live. I don't write much about the desert. And this is a story that involves the desert, involves the landscape where I've spent the last 25 years of my life. It's a very long, short story. I'm not going to put you through it, but I am going to read the last 3 sections of it. The only thing that you need to know about the plot, the only thing you need to know as background is that in America, the great American car trip that you take with your family is a kind of American mythology going across the country. What's happened at this point in the story is that Robert, who is the protagonist, and his second wife, Melissa, have started out in the northeast corner of my country in Boston in the middle of summer, and they have headed to the southwest, to where I live, in Phoenix. Along the way, they picked up Robert's son by a first marriage. He's been married to a woman named Cordelia. They picked up his son, Tommy. just about at midpoint. And from that point forward, the car trip has been a nightmare. Tommy is eager for his estranged father's attention. He's angry that Melissa is in his father's life. It has been a nightmare. They now find themselves in Phoenix. It's 117 degrees in Phoenix. If that were not enough to make tempers boil, the strain between them, the strain in that car, has now brought a simmer into that boil. And in a Phoenix Holiday Inn, Robert, trying to discipline his son, has his son talk back to him. Melissa steps in between them, and Tommy, the 11-year-old boy, tells Melissa to mind her own fucking business in those words. Melissa slaps him. And Robert, who should have been doing something long before this, seeing himself caught between the two people he loves most in the world, does nothing. Melissa, furious at him, throws them both out of the motel room. This story, these three sections, will pick it up from that point. I leave Melissa watching figure skating on TV while Tommy and I look around the motel for something for Tommy to eat. The bar is the only thing still open, and now Tommy has a Coke in a Tom Collins glass sitting on a table next to a video game and a roast beef sandwich that he's eating out of cellophane. I'm sitting here in a booth on the other side of the room. Tommy wipes his hands on his jeans between games of Pac-Man, I notice, but it's neither the mustard from the sandwich nor the moisture from the glass that he's wiping away. It's an adult gesture he's picked up since the last time I've seen him, one of several I've noticed over the last few days, like crossing his legs, ankle bone on top of knee. Tommy comes back to the booth when his quarters run out and takes a seat across from me, prepared for the talking to that he knows I'm going to give him. I say all the things to him that you'd expect me to, all the things I should have said when he mouthed off to Melissa, and he looks me in the eye and listens like he's not a bad kid, which he isn't. Once we get that over with, I say to him, "Are you ready to go back to the room?" "Sure, I suppose," Tommy says. "Is it too late to swim?" "Probably not," I tell him. "Just leave the money on the table," Tommy says. "They won't mind. It's a bar." "You know a lot about tavern etiquette, do you?" I answer. "I've been in a bar before," he says. I say, "I'm impressed." I try to catch the eye of our waitress, but she looks the other way. Then Tommy says, "And I've been slapped, too." "That's enough," I tell him. "Come on, let's go." Our room is down near the pool. Set in the midst of the parking lot, the pool seems tiny. It seems quiet and still and almost iridescent from here. Tommy and Melissa are both good swimmers, and all during the trip I paid extra to stay at motels where they can have a room near the pool deck, so that the two of them can go in and out of the water all evening. It pleases me to sit by the side of the pool and watch Melissa and Tommy doing laps together once the other guests have gone back to their rooms. Melissa breaststrokes while Tommy swims freestyle, his elbows bent as I've taught him, his head turned, his body back into the water just so. Long, smooth strokes. Melissa strokes with the ease and grace of someone who can stay afloat for no better reason than that she wants to. But the comfort I might take from watching the two of them swim, the luxury of a pool in this stifling desert air, the general sense of well-being that I might otherwise feel all around me, somehow none of that is enough tonight. Tommy walks to the side of me and a little ahead, and I find I'm glad for this, for I have no desire to touch Tommy, to put my hand on his shoulder in some fatherly way. I wish he was back with his mother, Cordelia, and not a part of this trip at all. It's one of those moments when there's nothing to look forward to, and I honestly think that another day of driving with Melissa and Tommy on unfamiliar roads in the middle of the desert may be more than I can stand. At the door to our room, I search my pockets for the key. Through a parting of the curtains, I can see the television screen. Melissa has turned down the sound. A skater rises from the ice, turning round and round in midair. It's a replay, slow motion. And for a moment, the skater is suspended, safe, aside from all natural law. Then the toe of her blade brings her back to the ice, and I wince, as I always wince, thinking what that must do to the ankle. "You didn't take the key," Tommy says. "You never take the key. Melissa does." And then he knocks, And Melissa answers. Then she opens the door, and Tommy goes in first. Then I say to her, "Someone has an apology for you. Did you ask about the air conditioner?" she asked. "The desk clerk says it's as low as it goes," I tell her. Melissa says, "Well, I still say it's hot in here." "There's always the pool," I tell her. "Tommy and I checked. The lights are still on if you're interested." "Where are you off to now?" she asks. I tell her, "I'm going to get us some Cokes to drink." Section 2. I pass one of the rooms down from ours, and I see on the television that they're watching skating too. Dick Button is talking to JoJo Starbuck, and there's footage of championship pairs from an earlier era. Carol Fox and Richard Daly, Julie Blumberg and Michael Siebert. The camera comes in, and there's a couple doing an amazing bit of business, a death spiral, this is called, in which the women's head is just inches over the ice. I'm trying to remember the couple's name. They're Russian, I think, or maybe Eastern European. When I hear a man walking out of his bathroom, and I move on down the walkway, I can't help myself. I try to find another window where I can see a TV that's carrying the competition. I find one where the drapes aren't quite shut near the soft drink machine, and I put my nose right up to the glass. That's crazy, I know. What will someone think if they see me? Well, let them think whatever they want. I'm tired and I'm worn down, and I don't want to go back to the room, not until everything's settled. And the heat out here feels good to me. It comes at you from everywhere, from the concrete beneath your feet, from the stone of the building itself. I need that right now. Melissa and Tommy have insisted on having the air conditioner in the car cranked up full blast, which makes every stop just a nightmare. The heat comes at you in force like a gang out here in the open. I feel prepared for it at the ready. I feel prepared for it at the ready as I never have before, and I vow never, ever to watch figure skating again unless it is in an overpowering heat and I can watch it in silence, and unless I can watch it like this on the sly. Ty Babylonia and Randy Gardner have just finished their routine, and Button is working them over. Why this? Why that? Ty has flowers in her arms. They look up toward the ceiling, awaiting their marks. She's smiling, then the smile fades, and Button says something to Randy, and Randy shrugs his shoulders, then Button takes a step forward and speaks directly to the camera. And after this, they cut to a commercial. The next thing I see on the screen is the logo Coca-Cola, and then a little girl with a soft drink. She's taking off a pair of roller skates. She's sobbing. Then the screen fills up with a title, Randy and Ty, Hopes for the Olympics. The title dissolves, and Ty and Randy are skating. It's early in the morning or very late at night, and it's an ordinary neighborhood rink, except that the ice is free and there's no one milling about. They're in warm-up clothes, skating together and then later alone. There are mazurkas and mohawks, sow cows and scratch spins, a toe loop jump, a chasse. Then a half lutz and a lutz. Then they go into moves which defy comprehension. There are triple sow cows, layover flying camels, laybacks and spirals. And then Ty falls on her can and goes scooting across the ice, her legs apart, and a look of disgust on her face. She finally comes to rest against the barricade wall. The screen goes back to the little girl again. She changes her mind and laces up her skates and skates away down the street. The camera pulls back, and you can see this is a neighborhood that hasn't existed in America for the last 50 years. It's tree-lined with gentle people on homey front porches. It's the perfect spot for this little girl, for cocker spaniels aren't high-strung here, and everyone stops for pedestrians, particularly blonde little girls on roller skates who might have their minds on their skating. Then a logo for the product appears again, Coke. This reminds me of why I'm out here in the first place, so I go to the machine and buy 3 cans of soda. I go back to the room and say, "We're all going ice skating." This makes sense if you've just seen Randy and Ty through the window of a motel room that you didn't have to pay for. It makes no sense at all if you're watching the news in a city you haven't been to before and making fun of the weatherman. I say to the two of them, "I'm serious. I'm taking you ice skating. My treat." "Your treat?" says Melissa. She looks at me as though I've been out drinking. Tommy says, Where do you think you're going to find an ice rink in the middle of the desert in the middle of summer? I look to Melissa for help, but she has an expression on her face that says, well, answer the boy. I say, right here. I saw it as we came in, an outdoor rink in the middle of the desert. I kid you not. It's about 20 minutes north of here, on Haddon. Hayden, Melissa says. She puts her feet on the floor and begins to stretch. Hayden Road, and it's south. Final section. We're here, Tommy says in the parking lot. I can see it myself, the lights, the sign up ahead, desert, ice, palace. We're here. There's nothing in Tommy's tone that seems to hold out much promise, and I know what he means. It's a strange arrangement. The setup is circular. There's a plexiglass wall that's 10 or 12 feet high, then a barricade inside that, one like you'd find in any rink, then inside that, the ice itself. Between the plexiglass and the barricade, there are benches and seats where you enter a place to rent skates and buy hot dogs and such, all of this sitting in the middle of the Arizona desert. The kid behind the counter is 16 or 17. He has a baseball cap on backwards, and he smells to me of beer. He tells me it's only 40 minutes until closing. I point to a sign behind him on the bulletin board and tell him it says he's open 24 hours. That's during tourist season, he says, October through March. Now we close out at midnight. Nobody comes here during the summer. Who'd come here during the summer? There are some ideas you have, which seem better when you have them than when you try to make them happen. And now that we're actually here, what seemed whimsical, vacation-y, seems to me to have been a terrible mistake. It was the kind of thing my own father would never have thought of doing, which made it seem perfect. That's something I've never been able to completely overcome, that is, trying to be the kind of father I never had. By the time we get our skates, says Tommy, there won't even be half an hour. I turn to them and say what Tommy said to me. We're here, I say. Pick out the ones you want. The first thing you have to have if you're a serious skater is a shoe that fits. So here's what you need to accept about shoes you're going to rent. You know at a rink like this, you'll be putting up with dull blades on uppers of irregular sizes. You don't make a big production out of this. You're not here to be serious. You're here to have fun. So you pick the kind of skate for the fun you want to have, either figure skates or hockey, and go out on the ice. That's the point I'm trying to make, that we're here on a lark, that we're skating for fun. Melissa settles on a pair of figure skates, size 6.5, half a size smaller than the street shoes she wears, while Tommy gets a pair for hockey. What about you? Melissa asked me. This whole thing was your idea. You wanted to go ice skating, remember? Sure, I answer. Why not just break a bone or two right now? Melissa's gonna skate, Tommy says. There's a difference, I tell him. Melissa's a good skater. Come on, says Melissa to Tommy, taking him by the hand. Let's put them on and show him what he's missing. I look out on the ice. An old man sculling gracefully is the only person left. There are a few kids at the other end of the rink, too, but they're not skating, just standing and talking, leaning against the barricade. I help Tommy lace up his skates while Melissa takes a turn around the rink. She comes back to us, and I say, well, how is it? The blades are off center, she says. Try tightening the laces, I suggest. But, you know, what about the rink? Tommy walks up and down the carpeted walk to get the feel of his hockey skates while on the other side of the barricade, Melissa tugs at her laces. Then Tommy tries out the rink for himself. I hear some commotion, and I look down to the other end of the rink where there are four or five boys around half as many girls. The boys seem to be getting a little rough with them, so I say softly to Melissa, what do you suppose that's all about? She's finishing her laces, and she doesn't quite hear. Down there, I continue. You suppose we should see if those girls will need a lift? I still didn't hear you, Melissa says, straightening up and facing me. I ask, do you suppose we ought to offer those little girls a lift home? Melissa looks to the other side of the rink and gives this some thought. No, those boys are safe. How can you tell? I ask. Because the dangerous boys are always the best boys, she says. The other girls have already left with them. I get the point, but I must look puzzled. She changes the subject. Where's Tommy? I watch as Tommy and Melissa skate out onto the ice and grow accustomed to their skates. I lean to the right, trying to get the best view of them. Tommy's as good a skater as any other little boy his age, I imagine, but it's a particular kind of skating he's learned. His feet wide apart, his knees bent, his weight shifted forward. It's a kind of skating better fit to turn and go drills in neighborhood rinks than skating hand in hand with a partner. Beside Melissa, he looks out of place and about to fall. It's not just that he's a little boy and that she's a woman old enough to be his mother, but really a stranger to him, or even the difference in their heights. Melissa moves the way figure skaters can, all beautiful gesture, making the smallest stroke seem like it runs in her blood. It's all in the transfer of weight from outside edge to inside, and these are not the sort of things we think to teach to little boys with hockey sticks. I call them over to where I'm sitting. You're a pretty impressive couple, I tell them. Are you having fun? Tommy looks up at Melissa. She looks down at him and says, I don't know. That's a good question. Are we having fun yet? Sure. I guess, he says. Tommy has his eyes on the teenagers at the other end of the rink. The boys are sitting on the barricades with cigarettes cupped in their hands. Maybe they aren't cigarettes, for all I know. They could be joints, dope. You'd never be able to tell out here in the open air. Tommy skates off, resigned to my presence. Melissa skates after him, but not before she says to me, having fun, and shakes her head. I am, actually. It's weird here. The surface is cold, yet the air is hot. It smells of cars and carbon monoxide, of week-old popcorn in one of those machines, of mesquite wood and pinyon, of aluminum ammonia disinfectant. It smells of foreign soil and desert life, and then things much more familiar, of cheap shoes and dirty feet, of petroleum and lubricants, and you have the sense that it's evaporating all around you. They've started shutting off some of the high-intensity lamps overhead so they'll be cool by closing time, and you can see from where I'm sitting that steam's rising all around us. It's just strange, that's all, to be here in the middle of the desert, in the middle of summer, near artificial ice. The sky overhead is starless and as black as a wide-open pit, and there's steam rising all around us, and there's this yellow and blue neon sign at the edge of the rink. It's supposed to say, Desert Ice Palace, and the ice is supposed to flash on and off so the word catches your eye from the road. Ice, ice, ice. But they're turning it off a section at a time, and now it looks as though the word hangs all by itself in the air. Ice. Hey, look at Melissa, Tommy calls. Melissa's rusty but impressive. She balances herself on one blade, then pushing off with the other, moves in a circle. She stops then and makes another circle using the other edge of her other blade. It's not a perfect figure eight, but it's an eight. You can tell what it is. I watch as she takes Tommy through the basics and listen to her coaching. Keep your weight over your outside hip, kiddo. Keep your eye on the tracing. Concentrate, Tommy. Don't break your concentration. Melissa comes over to where I'm sitting. She turns her back to me, resting her elbows on the barricade between us, and the two of us watch Tommy setting off on his own. What do you think? I ask her. About what, Tommy? They're closing down the rink for real now, turning off more of the lights, locking up the refreshment stand. We look down to the other end of the rink. The teenage girls are leaving with the boys who were bothering them. Stand up, Melissa says. She skates a few yards out on the rink, then stops so she's facing me. Turn around. What? Come on, she says. On your feet. What for? I do what she asks, then Melissa says, Are you safe? Am I what? You heard me, says Melissa. Are you safe? She waits for me to get it, and I do finally. And then I say, I'm a mental patient with a long history of violence. Melissa considers this, smiles, looks me up and down. She makes a circle in the air with her finger. Turn around. She weighs her options, looks up and down the rink. Okay, says Melissa. Go get some skates before they make us leave. I talk the kid at the counter into 15 more minutes, and as Tommy practices his push-off, Melissa and I skate a turn around the rink. I haven't been on skates for years, and it takes me a minute to find my stroke. I feel awkward and silly until I recover some long-forgotten rhythm, the one that keeps a foot beneath my center of gravity. Melissa skates as though I have kept her up past her bedtime, which I have, but she skates too with the natural ease that I've always needed to see in a partner, all changes of edges and crossovers, a pure distribution of weight that I need to see to remind me of my own. It feels good, I say to her. Weird, I ask. You know, nice. Weird is right, she says. Relax your hands. But she knows what I mean. It feels good being out on a rink with the people you love in this world. And it feels good to get better with each lap we take, for our movements get better for being sustained. And there's something to be said for long measured strides. Sometimes I think our marriage was a terrible mistake all around, for Melissa and for me and for our kids together. Some days I think I'm going to walk out tomorrow, which might be best all around. But I don't like being reminded of that. And here in the dark, I can put it to rest, because no one wants to live where women shake their babies to death. And it does feel nice to be in motion like this, on an artificial surface, in a part of the country where there'll be no change of seasons. Thank you.
Jay and I went to Coventry today, and they're putting the tree up in the cathedral, and so I'm going to read a story I never get to read because the season has begun. As soon as I find it. 28. You need to understand this about me, that I'm a literary writer, and my stories are dark and dire and full of angst, and they're not like this story at all. I'm going to read this with that in mind. I'm sort of kidding. This is a story called The H Street Sledding Record. I just got a letter 4 days ago from a young woman who's at college in Lookout Mountain, Georgia. She had read this story in her class, and she said that her parents had just bought a house on Fifth Avenue in Salt Lake City. She said, our address is 573 Fifth Avenue, which is on the avenues. The avenues go up to 23rd Avenue. And she said, it's between H Street and I Street. And she said, is that the house in the story? The H Street Sledding Record, and it is. It's the very house that I lived in 1971. She said, my parents are remodeling, and we'd love to have you come by and see what we're doing. I live in Phoenix. Jay and I both teach at Arizona State University, and this is going to be the first Christmas story you hear this season. It's really not too early. It's the night before Thanksgiving in the United States. Here we go. I've changed stories because of the hour, and this will fit the time. The H Street Sledding Record. The last thing I do every Christmas Eve is go out in the yard and throw the horse manure onto the roof. It is a ritual. After we return from making our attempt at the H Street Sledding Record, and we sit in the kitchen sipping eggnog and listening to Elise recount the sled ride, and Elise then finally goes to bed happily, reluctantly, and we finish placing Elise's presents under the tree, and we pin her stocking to the mantle with care, and Drew brings over two other wrapped boxes, which anyone could see are for me, and I slap my forehead, having forgotten to get her anything at all for Christmas, except for the prizes hidden behind the glider on the front porch. I go into the garage, and I put on the gloves, and then into the yard, where I throw horse manure onto the roof. Drew always uses this occasion to call my mother. They exchange all the Christmas news, but the main purpose of the calls the last few years has been for Drew to stand in the window where she can see me out there, lobbing the great turds up into the snow on the roof, and describe what I am doing to my mother. The two women take amusement from this. They say things like, you married him, and he's your son. I take their responses to my rituals as a kind of fond, subtle support, which it is. Drew had said that when she first discovered me throwing the manure on the roof, the Christmas that Elise was four, you're the only man I've ever known who did that. See, a compliment. But now that Elise is eight, Drew has become cautious. You're fostering her fantasies. I answer, kids grow up too soon these days. And then Drew has this. What do you want her to do? Come home from school in tears when she's 15? Some kid in her class will have said, oh sure, Santa's reindeer shit on your roof, eh? All I can say to Drew is this. Some kid in her class? Fine, I don't care what he says. I'm her father. I have thrown horse manure on our roof for 4 years now, and I plan to do it every Christmas Eve until my arm gives out. It satisfies me as a homeowner to do so for the wonderful amber stain that is developing between the swamp cooler and the chimney and is visible all spring and summer and fall as you drive down the hill by our house, and for the way the two rose bushes by the gutter spout have raged into new and profound growth during the milder months. And as a father, it satisfies me as a ritual that keeps my family together. Drew has said, you want to create evidence? Let's put out some milk and a cookie and then drink the milk and eat a bite out of the cookie. I looked at her. Drew, I had said, I don't like cookies. I never ate a dessert in my life. And like I said, Drew has been a good sport, even the year I threw one gob short and I ran a hideous smear down the kitchen window screen that hovered over us all until March, when I was able to take it down and take it to the car wash. I obtained the manure from my friend Bob, more specifically from his horse, Power, who lives just west of Heber. I drive out there the week before Christmas and I retrieve about a bushel. I threw it on the roof a lump at a time, wearing a pair of welding gloves my father gave me. I put the brake on our sled in the year 1975 when Drew was pregnant with Elise so we could still make our annual attempt on the H Street sledding record on Christmas Eve. It was the handle of a broken Louisville Slugger baseball bat, and it still had the precise 34 stamped into the bottom. I sawed it off square and drilled and bolted it to the rear of the sled so that when I pulled back on it, the stump would drag us to a stop. As it turned out, it was one of the 2 years when there was no snow. So we walked up to 11th Avenue and H Street, as we had promised, rain or shine, and we sat on the flexible flyer sled in the middle of the dry street on a starry Christmas Eve, and I held her in my lap. We sat on the sled like two basketball players contesting the possession of her belly. We talked a little about what it would be like when she took her leave from the firm, and I had her home all day with the baby. And we talked remotely about whether we wanted any more babies. And we talked about the record, the H Street sledding record, which was set on December 24th, 1969, the first Christmas of our marriage, when we lived in the neighborhood on Fifth Avenue in an old barn of a house, the total rent on which was $72.50, honest. And Drew had given me the sled that very night, and we walked out about midnight and had been surprised by the blizzard. No wonder we took the sled and walked around the corner up H Street, up to 11th Avenue, and without speaking or knowing what we were doing, opening the door on the second ritual of our marriage, the annual sled ride. The first ritual was the word condition and the activities it engendered in our droopy old bed. At the top, we scanned the city blurred in snow and sat on my brand new Christmas sled and set off. The sled rode high and effortlessly through the deep snow, and suddenly our hearts started and our eyes began to burn against the snowy air, and we were going faster than we'd planned. We crossed 10th Avenue, nearly taking flight in the dip, and then we descended in a dark rush, 9th, 8th, 7th, soaring across each avenue, my arms wrapped around Drew like a straitjacket to drag her off with me if a car should come in front of us on 6th, 5th Avenue, 4th. This all took seconds, do you see? Until a car did turn onto H Street, headed our way, and we veered the new sled sharply up over the curb, dousing our speed in the snowy yard, one house from the corner of 3rd Avenue. Drew took a real face full of snow, which she squirmed around and pressed into my neck, saying the words, "Now that's a record." And it was the record, 11th to 3rd. And it stood partly because there had been two Christmases with no snow, partly because of assorted spills brought on by too much speed, too much laughter, sometimes too much caution, and by a light blue Mercedes that crossed 6th Avenue just in front of us in 1973. And though some years were flops, there was nothing about Christmas that Elise looked forward to as much as our one annual attempt at the H Street sledding record. I think Drew wants another baby. I'm not sure, but I think she wants another child. The signs are so subtle, they barely seem to add up, but she says things like, "Remember before Elise went to school?" And, "There's sure a lot of women in their mid-30s having babies." I should ask her, but for some reason I don't. We talk about everything. But I've avoided this topic. I've avoided talking to Drew about this topic because I want another child too badly for her not to want one. I want a little boy to come onto the yard on Christmas morning and say, "See, they're on the roof. The reindeer were there." I want another kid to throw horse manure for. I'll wait. It will come up one of these days. I'll find a way to bring it up. Christmas is coming. Every year on the day after Halloween, I tip the the sled out of the rafters in the garage, and Elise and I sponge it off, clean the beautiful dark blonde wood with furniture polish, enamel the nick spots on the runner supports with black engine paint, and rub the runners themselves with waxed paper. It is a ritual done on the same plaid blanket in the garage, and it takes all afternoon. When we are finished, we lean the sled against the wall, and Elise marches into the house. "Okay now," she says to my mother, to her mother, "let it snow." On the first Friday night in December, every year, Elise and Drew and I go by our tree. This, too, is ritual. Like those families that bundle up and head for the wilderness so that they can trudge through the deep, pristine snow, chop down their own little tree, and drag it step by step all the way home, we venture forth in the same spirit. Only we take my old pickup down to State Street and find some joker who's thrown up two strings of colored lights around the corner of a parking lot of a burned-out Safeway grocery and is proffering trees to the general public. There's something magical and sad about this little forest just sprung up across from City Tacos, and Drew and Elise and I wander the wooded paths waiting for some lopsided pinion to leap into our hearts. The winter Drew and I became serious when I was a senior and she was already in her first year at law school, I sold Christmas trees during vacation. I answered a card on the dorm bulletin board and went to work for a guy named Gear, who had cut 2,000 squat pinions from the hills east of Cedar City and was selling them from a dirt lot on Redwood Road. Drew's mother invited me to stay with them for the holidays, and it gave me the chance to help Drew make up her mind about me. I would sell trees until midnight with Gear and then drive back to Drew's and watch every old movie in the world and wrestle with Drew until our faces were mashed blue. I wanted to complicate things wonderfully by having her sleep with me. She wanted to keep the couch cushions between us and think it over. It was a crazy Christmas. We'd steam up the windows in the entire living room, but she never gave in. We did develop the joke about condition, which we still use as a code word for desire. And later, I won't say if it was spring or fall, when Drew said to me, "I'd like to see you about this condition." I knew everything was going to be all right and that we'd spend every Christmas together for the rest of our lives. One night during that period, I delivered a tree to University Village, the married students housing off Sunnyside. The woman was waiting for me with the door open and as I dragged the pine up the steps to the second floor. She was a girl, really, about 20, and her son, about 3, watched the arrival from behind her. When I had the tree squeezed into the apartment, she asked if I could just hold it for a minute while she found her tree stand. "If you ever need to stall for a couple of hours, just say you're looking for your tree stand." I mean, the girl was gone for 20 minutes. I stood and exchanged stares with the kid, who was scared. He didn't understand why some strange man had brought a tree into his house. "Christmas," I said to him. "Christmas, can you say Merry Christmas?" I was an idiot. When the girl returned with her tree stand, she didn't seem in any hurry to set it up. She came over to me and showed me the tree stand, holding it up for an explanation as to how it worked. Close up, the girl's large eyes had an odd look in them, and then I understood it when she leaned through the boughs and kissed me. It was a great move. I had to hand it to her. There I was holding the tree. I couldn't make a move either way. It has never been among my policies to kiss strangers, but I held the kiss in the tree. Something about her eyes. She stepped back with the sweetest look of embarrassment and hope on her pretty face that I'd ever seen. "Just loosen the turn screws in the side of that stand," I said finally, "and we can put this tree up." By the time I had the tree secured, she had returned again with a box of ornaments, lights, junk like that, and I headed for the door. "Thanks," I said. "Merry Christmas." Her son had caught on by now and was fully involved in unloading the ornaments. The girl looked up at me, and this time I saw it all. Her husband coming home in his cap and gown last June, saying, "Thanks for law school, honey, but I met Doris at the jurisprudence ball, and I've got to be me. Just keep the kid." The girl said to me, "You could stay and help." It seemed like two statements to me, so I answered them separately. "Thank you, but I can't stay. That's the best help. Have a good Christmas." And I left them there together, decorating that tree, a ritual against the cold. "How do you like it?" Elise says to me. She has selected a short, broad bush which seems to have grown in two directions at once and then given up. She sees the look on my face and says, "If you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. Besides, I've already decided this is the tree for us." "It's a beautiful tree," Drew says. "Quasimodo," I whisper to Drew. "This tree's name is Quasimodo." "No whispering," Elise says from behind us. "What's he saying now, Mom?" "He said he likes the tree too." Elise is not convinced, and after a pause, she says, "Dad, it's Christmas. Behave yourself." When we go to pay for the tree, the master of ceremonies is busy negotiating a deal with two kids, a punk couple. The tree man stands with his hands in his change apron and says, "I got to get 35 bucks for that tree." The boy, a skinny kid in a leather jacket, shrugs and says he's only got $28. His girlfriend, a large person with a bowl haircut and a monstrous black overcoat festooned with buttons, is wailing, "Please, oh no, Jimmy, Jimmy, I love that tree, I want that tree." The tree itself stands aside, a noble pine of about 12 feet. Unless these kids live in a gymnasium, they're buying a tree bigger than their needs. Jimmy retreats to his car, an old Plymouth big as a boat. Police rule is spray painted on both doors in balloon letters. He returns instantly and opens a handful of coins. "I'll give you 31 bucks, 55 cents, and my watch." To our surprise, the wily tree man takes the watch to examine it. When I see that, I give Elise $4 and tell her to give it to Kid Jimmy and say Merry Christmas. His girlfriend is still wailing, but now a minor refrain of, "Oh, Jimmy, that tree, oh, Jimmy," etc. I haven't seen a public display of emotion and longing of this magnitude in Salt Lake City ever. I watch Elise give the boy the money, but instead of saying Merry Christmas, I hear her say instead, "Here, Jimmy, Santa says keep your watch." Jimmy pays for the tree, and his girl, and this is the truth, jumps on him, wrestles him to the ground in gratitude, and smothers him for nearly a minute. There have never been people happier about a Christmas tree. We pay quickly and head out before Jimmy or his girlfriend can think to begin thanking us. On the way home in the truck, I say to Elise, "Santa says keep your watch, eh?" "Yes, he does," she smiles. "How old are you, anyway?" 8. It's an old joke, and Drew finishes it for me. When he was your age, he was 7. We will go home, and while two women begin decorating the tree with artifacts of our many Christmases together, I will thread popcorn onto a long string. It's a ritual I prefer for its uniqueness, the fact that once a year, I get to sit and watch the two girls I'm related to move about a tree inside our home while I sit nearby and sow food. On the morning of the 24th of December, Elise comes into our bedroom already dressed for sledding. "Good news," she says. "We've got a shot at the record." Drew rises from the pillow and peeks out the blind. "It is snowing," she says. Christmas Eve, we drive back along the snowy avenues and park on 5th as always. "I know," Elise says, hopping out of the car. "You two used to live right over there before you had me, and it was a swell place and only cost $72.50 a month, honest." Drew looks at me and smiles. "How old are you?" I ask Elise, but she is busy towing the sled away around the corner up toward 11th Avenue. It is still snowing. Petal flakes, teeming by the street lamps, trying to carry the world away. I take Drew's hand and we walk up the middle of H Street behind our daughter. There's no traffic, but the few cars have packed the tender snow perfectly. It could be a record. On 9th Avenue, Drew stops me in the intersection. The world's still as snow and kisses me. "I love you," she says. "What a planet," I whisper, "to allow such a thing." By the time we climb to 11th Avenue, Elise is seated on the sled ready to go. "What are you guys waiting for? Christmas?" she says, and then laughs at her own joke. Then she becomes all business. "Listen, Dad, I figure if you stay just to the left of the tire tracks, we could go all the way. And no wobbling." She's referring to last year's record attempt, which was extinguished in a fatal wobble on the 8th Avenue block when we laughed ourselves silly. We arrange ourselves on the sled as we have each Christmas Eve for 8 years. As I reach my long legs around these two women, I sense their excitement. "It's going to be a record," Elise whispers into the whispering snow. "Do you think so?" Drew asks. She also feels this could be the night. "Oh, yeah," Elise says. "The conditions are perfect." "What do you think?" Drew turns to me. "Well, the conditions are perfect." When I say conditions, Drew leans back and kisses me. So I press. "There's still room on the sled," I say, pointing to the F inflexible flyer that is visible between Elise's knees. "There's still room for another person." "Who would that be?" Elise asks. "Your little brother," Drew says, squeezing my knees. And that's about all that was said, sitting up there on 11th Avenue on Christmas Eve on a sled which is as old as my marriage, with a brake that is as old as my daughter. Later tonight, I will stand in my yard and throw this year's reindeer droppings onto my very own home. I love Christmas. Now, the snow spirals around us softly. I put my arms around my family and lift my feet onto the steering bar. We begin to slip down H Street. We are trying for a record. The conditions, as you know by now, are perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. you, gentlemen. That was sublime. That's great. Now, I've got a load of dumb questions here, which really, after that, I don't want to ask. But
you can ask anything you want.
I'm going to salvage the one, which is that I'm very interested in getting books and writers into media, such as the internet, and onto TV, where you don't expect them. You don't expect to find them in the UK. This show on KABT,
right.
Public TV,
right.
Called Books and Company. How does that work?
Well, we started it about 10 years ago, and it was just the impetus of the Piper Center didn't exist at that time, but there was a great deal of interest. Phoenix is a strange American town in that Jay and I have been there and watched it come to kind of cultural critical mass. So we were there. It was a sleepy desert place where authors, when they traveled the country, would fly from Los Angeles to Denver, and now that's all changed. And change started changing about 10 years ago. The authors would come to Phoenix. The university is a rich place. There's lots of writing going on of all kinds. And so we started interviewing writers. There are lots of writers who lived in Arizona. We were talking to local people. One woman wrote a book about her life in a lookout tower in the forest. And there was a famous novelist who lived in Williams, Arizona, had written 60 books. I met her. And then anybody who came to town, we interviewed Annie Proulx and Tim O'Brien, other well-known American writers. And these are half-hour interviews, straight up, no commercial, and I talk to them. I'm very interested in how books are written, and it isn't about how the book is doing, and it's not so much really what the book's about, but I'm interested in the artist's process. So, and it's been a successful and a prize-winning program for KAET. What they did now is the Piper Center's helping, and they sponsor 3 or 4 programs a year. We were doing, I guess we've done 110 programs total. I know I've interviewed 70 authors, I think, and my partner who does nonfiction has done the rest. But it's won awards there, and we have a lot of people, and everywhere you go, someone comes up and they it's that one thing that's on television that's different from anything else. And so it's we're very proud of it as a kind of a cultural note for ourselves and our town. And there's a budget. It's money to do these things. They give me enough. I get paid just enough to do my laundry and pay parking. And so I don't, in fact, I should start deducting. I should buy some new clothes and deduct it. In the United States, we have an interesting tax phenomenon. But I don't. And so, but the program costs are expensive. And so we underwrite. Arizona Humanities Council helps us. And we have One Book Arizona. I don't know if you have One Book Coventry or One Book Warwick, where they take a book and everybody reads it. It's a complicated, we're still going with it. And so we interview that author. And any author that people might have an interest in, then we try to interview them.
Can you just describe how that One Book idea works? How we could do something like that over here?
Well, it started in other cities, and then Phoenix picked it up. Chicago had One Book, and the trouble is picking the book, because the debate on that, it goes on and on, especially in some conservative places. But Chicago picked To Kill a Mockingbird. And in Arizona, we picked one of Barbara Kingsolver's novels 2 years ago, and last year it was a book called Something. And and so everybody reads it. It's made available, and the author comes, and there's several programs. There's panels for people who want to talk about it critically. There's readings for people who want to meet the author. And it's, again, a kind of a community cultural endeavor. So we've had it 4 years now, or 5. But some of these communities, and I don't mean in the East or the West, but you run into certain concerns about what a book might be. And I work in a university, and my job is to shake people up. And so I'm interested in books that are asking us to reach and don't offer the accepted dogma. And sometimes that discussion gets pretty, as we say in mathematics, nice. And but we've been able to pick books. Ironically, I just add one footnote. This year, there are 2 books. It's, I don't know, I said, and I've got to interview both authors at one time. And it's based on this, a couple went down the Grand Canyon in 1929 and disappeared, quote unquote. And so one person's written a novel about that, and the other person's written as much documentary nonfiction on it as I can. And so it's 2 different takes. It'll actually be wonderful, but I told them if they go to 3 books next year, they can look for somebody else.
Jay, one of the things that struck me since we first started the partnership, which is only really 9 months old now, is the seismic difference between something like the Piper Center and the writing program here, which is 8 years old, and despite its youth, it's actually quite a large one. What kind of things do you think our students, the members of the public, could kind of pick up from this partnership, or can kind of pick up from the States? Some specific things that we can learn fast from you?
Those aren't the terms that I personally would think about it in. I've spent 3 days with you, 2 days with you. It seems to me that you have enormous talent, great energy here. That is very nice to walk into. Our program is a bit older. It's a bit more staid. I think that there is a great chance for exchange here, a great chance for symbiosis. Mainly, what you see is a glowing common denominator, and that is people who have an interest in writing, whether it's on this side of the Atlantic or my side, people who want to write better, people who want to share that writing with somebody else, people whose cultural experiences and somehow inform that writing. My culture is different than your culture, but we have much more in common than separates us. And I suspect if you could see my side of it, you'd come to pretty much that same conclusion. It looks to me like there's great chance here for exchange of thought, but also to find a great commonality between us, that we're all laboring to try to get those words on the page, that we want somebody to read us, you know? And that it's important that we can articulate wherever we are, when we are, and why we are. More like that, I think.
That's great. Could I ask for the lights to go up, please, so I can see you if you have questions in the audience? I can hear Frankie the dog has got some responses to this. Ignore him for now, feed him a biscuit. Some questions. And gesticulate wildly. Helen.
Okay. It's like an option, isn't it, really, that I breathe. It struck me that both of you wrote the collection of stories that absolutely depend on a sense of place, and that you have a very strong sense of place in communicating and writing, which informs the writing. It also seemed to me that in some ways you're very lucky, because the places that you write about have a resonance. I mean, even here in Coventry, the places that you write about have almost a mythological resonance in the US and in the UK. So I wondered if you, and this is really a question to both of you in turn, how does that particular place that you inhabit, that you dwell in, affect your imagination as authors? And to what extent does it dictate or suggest the ways in which you write?
That's true.
Well, it's a really good question. We don't speak about it directly enough in fiction, but it's also a great element of nonfiction too. And places, I'm absolutely dependent on place. I require it. And one of my friends, the writer Shelby Heron, said, "Nothing happens nowhere." And so, I think, and then I turn on that. I think place is, in a way, fate. So I'm very interested in having bodies in a place. I'm a scenic writer, and so, yeah, I try not to trade. The story I read tonight is famous in Salt Lake City, and I don't want to talk about it in a way. It's just I picked the wrong town to be famous in, but you don't need to know about Salt Lake City and the way it's laid out, nor its dominant culture, nor any of this XYZ to get the sense of that story. And each of those small places, I'm very interested in the inventory, and I'm constantly working when a student writes a story. I'm interested in the texture, the ambient light, all of that. And I look at the stories that I'm writing. I use place to find the story. I didn't know where that story was going. We talked about it in the workshop, and I talked about it today in the class. But the component parts help you create a constellation, which then you can extrapolate where the next steps are going to be. And I'm dependent on it. Part B. When I write a monologue, it's a little different. Sometimes you have a monologue and just some voice is speaking, and then you let him go or her go. But in my stories, in most of my stories, and especially in the last, the story that, even the story I was going to read about, the one that will be in Harper's, is dependent on that place, even on the room, the classroom, or wherever you're. So it's, and I take a long time. I don't hurry on. Even if I know what's going to happen, I take a long time letting the light fall through the window or giving the texture of the blankets or the way that the car is full of cigarette smoke or whatever. I need it. I need it because I need to believe the moment so that I can stay careful with my scene.
Mine, I think, is, if I'm to be candid with you, is really contrived. The workshop I did last night, I brought anybody who took the workshop got one of two plays that I'd done, and I had them with me, the sides from them, just because they were set in Arizona. I've only had two of the plays are set in Arizona. This, I think, is the only piece of fiction I've ever set in Arizona. I think Arizona is a fascinating place. Part of what fascinates me about it, you can see in the little piece I read, it's completely inhospitable to human life. It is completely inhospitable to human life. That, you know, that kind of heat and that kind of desert landscape has provoked people as they settled to build not really ice rinks in the middle of a desert, but to find ways to bring water to where water should not be, to find a way to put trees where trees have no business. I'm fascinated by the idea that you can somehow implant your own desire on this harsh terrain in order to make a life there. But that's a passing interest for me. If you read other things I'd written, many of my things are set in New York. I'm from New York, or Boston. I'm from Boston. I mean, that's really, for me, it isn't nearly so much the desert landscape. I'll ask Ron a question. He may not want to follow up on this. But you feel like you're very much a Southwest writer, don't you? I mean, you've talked about that, about being a writer.
The West. I like the West. I like being kind of out of it and marginalized by the rest. And I do like the West. And I went back West. I lived in Connecticut for 10 years. While Jay was talking, I was thinking, I set two stories in London of mine. I lived in London for 6 months once in Hampstead, and I wrote a map of the pubs on the high street and into these stories. I got in trouble for the story. It was called the Hotel Eden, which is where we used to drink after hours with some friends. And in the story, one thing led to another, and eventually they're on a train, and I had them going up. There's a place in northern Scotland on the coast, and I think it may be Cape Dread. Does anyone know this?
Cape Wrath.
What's the word?
Cape Wrath.
Wrath. Wrath?
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, I mean Wrath. No, I'm absolutely with you. And so I put the train, I wanted the train to go there because it was such a dire name. And then I got called out on it a little bit. But as a fiction writer, if you can get most of the story solid, you can move the train.
Any other questions? No,
I'm interested in opening sentences, and we heard Ron, we didn't hear Jane, because he began to read his last few sections. I wonder if Jane could read his opening sentence, and let each of you prepare, tell us about what you think the opening sentence of the story should, and absolutely should not do.
Mm-hmm. And the rest of you can write on from those opening sentences for 500 words.
Do you want to do that one first? Want me to do it?
No, I do.
My opening sentence is, my wife Melissa is in the kitchen making small talk with Anita while Anita loads the dishwasher and I sit by myself in the living room. That's the opening sentence. Anita's a character I didn't mention. They've stopped in Phoenix to see an old friend, Anita. How that sentence came about? I mean, let me tell you why this is not a play. It is not a play because I could not figure out how to write it as a play. What I hear in that opening sentence is present tense. I wanted to write a story in present tense. I wanted to have a story that was going to plot in present tense. And I like the rhythm of that opening sentence. And I like the fact that it immediately puts you in present tense. It if this story is going to work for you, you're going to have to buy into this premise. And if you don't read on to my second sentence, you're not going to like this story no matter what I do for you. So I want that first sentence to put you in the sort of rhythm and the place and the time and what my approach is. I think you probably only have about two sentences to get most readers. And so that's what that is for me. It's just to make sure you know that you're in present tense. And go with me.
Yeah, for me it's a process issue. I mean, if I start very small, I start very tight. And if I don't, if the sentence is a larger sentence, for instance, I just finished the story and I wrote the first sentence is the last sentence I wrote, and it is that Graven had made two decisions in his life. And it's the sentence. And then I said the first one was and the second one was. But you can see how I got that later. That's a topic sentence, really. Most of my good sentences are they start very close, in the Governor's Ball, which I talked about last night, or in that story, I wrote a story called The Potato Gun. And the guy says, I was in the garage, I was talking to my son Trevor about this strange construction project in the garage when I got the call. So I like such a sentence, because that phone call, he doesn't get the phone for 1,500 words while he's wrestling with this other problem. And so by the time I finished the first opening section, I had two things going at once. I'm not interested in the reader at all. I don't know about the reader. I hope I find one. I hope they come along. They won't unless I finish. I'm interested in finding a way to finish. And so I have a story that starts, there was a camera. I gave it to my class as an assignment, and I thought, in my story, that camera was going to be a mystery. We'd get the camera, then develop the pictures, and something lurid would be proved. But in fact, we never got to the camera. It was just a way of starting. By the end of that first paragraph, the camera was in an old wrecked car in the trunk, and it was dislodged when they came to the wrecking yard and moved the car up onto a truck. The Governor's Ball, the first sentence is, I didn't know until we'd loaded the 10-ton wet carpet onto the truck, and I was soaked with the dank rust water that the Governor's Ball was that night. So now I have two problems. I have a load of junk and the Governor's Ball. I have a ticking clock. I'll say lastly, working with writers, I have an exercise or approach called the ticking clock, and where I gave it out last night as we finished in that little semester's work we did in an hour. My apologies. But your responsibility in the first paragraph is to establish the ticking clock. And for example, you know, we needed to find three bow ties and get to the reception by 7. You know, that's a really good first sentence, because there's a lot of work. You've laid out a lot of work for yourself. I'm interested in ways of not stopping. People always ask me questions about how do you make it good, and we can talk about that. But I'm so much more interested in how I didn't stop. People say, "Oh, that was the backstroke. You did the backstroke all the way. Such a beautiful backstroke story. You're such a backstroke genius." And they say, "How do you do the backstroke?" I say, "And the truth is, if they'd seen me writing the story, I was just trying not to drown. I was just trying to keep my nose up every once in a while, not take so much water, not cough to death." I haven't answered your question, but there's a lot of talk about the first sentences about, Jay's right, you do need to get something going. As our friend Mark Richard used to say, get busy. Don't stall me out. We saw a lot of writers fall by the wayside because they stalled us out. Think, oh, this will be important. Aldous Huxley's first paragraph of Brave New World is such a great, but I don't want to write that paragraph about the squat gray building sat there. And he's up to something, and we have to read on, but I'm not setting the furniture out. I want the play to start, and then the actors can bring the furniture out later.
And the final question from, is it Mark?
That's Sheila.
Sheila, yes. Sorry.
Were any of the elements of those stories autobiographical?
I'll just go first. I'll say the things I knew about the H Street Slitting Record were, A, that I lived in Salt Lake City, so I knew the city, and I used it as a structure. I will use real places. I'll use Phoenix. The worst first sentence in the world I could write is, we were traveling down Bloomfield Avenue, because I would have made it up. And my next sentence would be, there's no Bloomfield Avenue, I quit. So I use real places. Secondly, my father-in-law, who was a giant of a man, a wonderful man, did it. He threw horse manure on the roof. And my wife brought it into our marriage. She said, did you know? And he was a character in the classic sense of a character. So then I married that. I don't have a daughter. I did set the H Street sledding record, and it still stands. One night with a friend. It wasn't part of my marriage, but we didn't know what we were doing. We nearly got killed. The side streets, the level streets, were dry. We were going so fast that sparks flew out of the runners. And actually, he signed. I had a paper note as a joke. I had it notarized, and we signed it, and I framed it. But I had that around 10 years before I did this. So I did sell Christmas trees. No one ever kissed me while I was holding a tree. But you get inside a house with a tree in close proximity and with a woman, there's a dynamic. You can have a kiss. It is my policy not to kiss strangers. And then there's one other thing. The word condition is a play on another, you know how I wanted to make something personal in there, but that isn't something I had. You make discoveries, and people are always saying, as we said last night, Sheila, they said, did that happen to you? And you've got to take it, first of all, it's from people who are trying to write and struggle with that issue. Do you use your personal experiences? And as I said last night, the answer is yes, you use your personal experiences whether you've had them or not. And then the other problem is that the thing is, did that happen? No. Is it true? Yes. That's what you're trying to do. So again and again in my work, the germ, I'll just say in that Harper story, I'm going on a minute here, but in that Harper story, the germ was a terrible, strange, comical incident that happened in a speech class when I was a freshman in college. I saw one student hurl another across the room as part of his speech on how to self-defend yourself. And I kept it, and 30 years later, I used it as the germ, and I wrote toward it. And the story, so that's the motor, the story I draw myself through. Here, if we analyze my story, you see what I'm doing. I start with the Christmas stuff, that's all fun. But the under agenda then, it just kept coming back, is, are they going to have another baby? Is there another baby? So that swims under the boat and pokes its nose up at a nice place toward the end. So.
Okay. The trappings of that little piece that I read are all real. There really is a Hayden Road.
With the rink on it.
There really is a rink. It's not a rink like I've made up. I'm not sure what the engineering of that would entail, but there really is a skating rink. When she says south, it really is south of where they would have to be. With that said, I think, I've never written anything out of my own life in terms of autobiographical story. I may have at some point, but I've never published any. I don't think I've published things like that. I encourage my students not to write out of their own life in that sense. I know, at least in American programs, many people have to have confidence in this, and they may be right and I'm wrong. But, you know, never write about things that you don't understand. I love bringing on characters on stage who know things I don't know. I love bringing engineers on stage. I love bringing physicists on stage. I love bringing homemakers on. I love bringing people on stage that I have to go to the library and learn how their minds would have, what information they would have at their fingertips. The trappings of my things are none. The rest of it's
made up. Ever, come on, you peeked in a motel window, put your head up against and watched TV in there for free, you weren't paying for them, did you?
That was a long time ago. That was a very long time ago. I was much younger.
I was kidding.
He's joking. Always joking.
That's what we do in America. I'm so worried. These people are going to say, those two people, I hope they seek help.
Yes.
But don't, no, we are seeking help. It's part of the reason we've been sent away.
Hey, you may have noticed that there were no books for sale outside today. Part of the reason for a partnership like this between the two universities is to promote the work of American writers in this country who were hitherto less well known. But I'll give you a very, very heavy hint outside of the commercial world of bookshops, which is ignore the bookshop. Go onto Amazon.co.uk and you can order books by all the writers who are performing as part of the festival, and at bargain price too. And also, it's a good idea to shortcut these things. If you make a demand upon Amazon online, our bookshop and bookshops will start ordering these books. Create the demand, let's create a market for this work, and then the books will fall. All of you...
In time for Christmas, by the way. Sorry.
All of you...
I'm saying anything. Go ahead. No, it's your program, seriously.
All of you are invited to speak further to Melissa Pritchard, to Jill Parker Rhodes, who are here, and to Jay and to Ron over drinks immediately after this in the National Grid room. I hope I've ordered enough. I'm sure I have. But we can order more. Okay. Now, please, will you come back at 7:30 and join Melissa Pritchard and Jill Parker Rolls? And I just rather soberly toast our partnership.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, absolutely. Yes.
And please. Say thanks, please, to Ron Carlson.